Good evening, and welcome to Health Writers on the Air. I'm your host, Andy Ambler. This evening's program will feature an interview with Dave Johnson, a nuclear engineer who has worked in plants all over the world, including some of which are identical to the plant in Fukushima. We'll get his take on the crisis in Japan. Also tonight, we'll receive updates on the people's occupation of the Capitol and our struggle against Governor Walker's attack on the Commons. Health writer Rob Lewis will report on the Walker administration's attack on the Wisconsin State Library system, and we'll listen to some of Rob's interviews with various protesters recorded over the last month. Next, health writer MJ LaPlay will be reporting on new actions taking place at the Capitol. But let's kick off the show with Dave Johnson and the crisis in Japan. Dave lives in Madison and came down to the studio here at WRT to speak with me the other day. Let's listen to that conversation. I'm here tonight with Dave Johnson, and he is a startup engineer for seven nuclear power plants over his career in the nuclear industry. He had helped with the Point Beach nuclear plant north of Two Rivers, Wisconsin on Lake Michigan. Bringing up this topic, obviously, is the issues over in Japan as a result of the 9.0 magnitude earthquake and the following tsunami. There's a lot of issues with the nuclear power plants over on the coast over there, and actually threats of core meltdown, partial meltdown, and we got Dave here with us today to kind of help us understand what's at stake and give us a little bit more information about what he knows on this situation over in Japan. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks. Well, as we said, if we had had this interview 3 weeks ago, it would have been completely different, because I was pretty much shaken to the core by what happened there. And I don't think anybody ever envisioned something like that. And so it's been a real shock to me.
Yeah, it is actually a humanitarian crisis that's being overlooked now by the crisis in Libya and the ongoing revolutions in northern Africa and the areas. What is the latest that you know about the situation in Japan? Can you tell me more about what you know?
Yeah, they say now that they're starting to bring the reactors under control. Now, that part of that is a natural thing, because after the reactor trips, it takes about 4 days, and the decay heat decays off naturally pretty quickly. So just through the passage of time, things have gotten better. And also, they apparently have managed to get some water in there. And the spent fuel pools are the things that have always concerned me. Even though before this happened, I don't think anybody thought much about those pools. They just sat there. But if they are losing water, which apparently they are, they've lost water, that could be serious, because that's not in the containment. That is just sitting in a concrete block building with a roof on it. And nobody ever envisioned that would be part of a crisis. And so I think in any future plants, if they build any future plants, they certainly will do better on containing the spent fuel pool, because it turns out to be the number one hazard. There's nothing really to prevent the clouds of radioactive steam, if those rods were to melt, from just simply being released in the atmosphere. And what the danger is, it depends on how long those elements have been in there. The number two unit that was shut down, well, it was probably shut down for refueling, which would mean that they brought a few fresh fuel elements out there, and that would make it a very hot situation.
Well, the latest that I heard was something about the power station is reaching or near the boiling point. And it's a storage pool that's holding 2,000 tons of spent nuclear fuel rods.
Yeah, I read that too.
And what are the implications if all the water boils away? I mean, what could happen?
Well, what could happen would be that the cladding on the fuel rods would melt at, I forget the degree, something like 2,000 degrees or something, an awful lot of heat. And then possibly the uranium pellets would also melt, and you might end up with a molten pool of radioactive elements in the bottom of the pool. And I should add that there's no danger of atomic explosions or nuclear explosions. That's just not the problem they're facing is decay heat. They just can't seem to find a way to remove it. And I don't think you have to realize, too, that no one can actually go in there. It's all just speculation. The instruments, I'm sure, are all blown to pieces, and there's no way to know what is going on in there. It may be that it'll all work out and the containments will hold. And, of course, it's a disaster for the power company and for Japan. But for the citizens, it wouldn't be. Or it might be that there's terrible things going on in there, and they really don't know.
Well, in the corporate media, you're hearing a lot about, or they use the terms radiation or radioactive contamination. And what they really don't analyze there is that those are two completely different terms and two completely different ideas. Could you explain to us more what you mean there?
Yeah, and that's an important distinction, and you're right, Andy, they don't make that distinction, and it's confusing for me, it's confusing for certainly for people who aren't familiar with them. Radiation, what they're talking about is mainly gamma radiation, which is basically an X-ray, and it's just it's a field that is given off from the reactor, and it doesn't make you radioactive, it'll go right through you, and it can kill you. There's a thing called LD50, which means that's called lethal device, lethal dose 50, which means that 50% of the people who are exposed to that will die. And, of course, you don't know which 50 because it's very variable. But that's just radiation. Now, contamination is particles, fuel, pieces of things. These are all subatomic, but they get into your lungs. They get into your if you have a cut, or if you ingest it in food, then that's a body burden, and that stays in your body forever. You can't walk away from it, and it keeps emitting radiation and doing damage. And it depends on where that lodges. It depends on what it is, and it depends on the half-life of the thing that is there. And in some ways, it just depends on luck. And one of the things we were always told was if you ingested it, the best thing is to drink a lot of beer and to get it out of there, just flush it out. And otherwise, as far as your body, you just shower. It's just elements, and the only difference is that they are radioactive. And when they talk about the radiation that is bad for the population, that's mainly what they're talking about. That's what the cloud would be. The contaminated radiation is pretty simple. You just walk away from it, and it's like light. It varies as the square of the distance. So if you're twice as far away, you only get a fourth of the radiation. So that radiation is very dangerous for the people working in the plant, but it really isn't dangerous for other people. The other people, the problem is contamination, and that's dangerous enough.
So how would this disaster be different than Chernobyl, I mean, in regards to them mm-hmm. containing?
Well, Chernobyl didn't have any containment. Chernobyl just sat in a concrete building, and I guess the Russians were so confident that nothing would happen that they didn't feel that they had to have any containment. Now, all American nuclear plants, I'm sure all nuclear plants, I would guess now, have a strong containment. Some have domes. That's pretty familiar. You see the dome. That's the pressurized water reactors. Now, these are boiling water reactors, and they're one of the two types, is Westinghouse and GE. GE builds the boiling water, and Westinghouse, the pressurized water. And these were boiling water reactors, and that containment is a different type of containment. It depends more on steam being squelched in a pool of water, whereas the other dome just simply contains the radiation. Now, Three Mile Island had a dome, and these don't have domes.
I read that the Fukushima plants were designed to withstand 6.9 magnitude earthquakes, and that historically Japan has had earthquakes of that magnitude or higher. Shouldn't governments regulate these designs to withstand the most extreme disasters?
Well, actually it is. But you have to have design numbers. You have to postulate something. And I don't think anybody, they may say now that they postulated a 9.0, but I don't think so. And what the American plants, the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, would postulate what they called a maximum credible accident, an MCA. And the company building the reactor had to show that if that maximum credible accident were to happen, that no harm would come to the public and that it would take no action on a part of the operators. Now, of course, what's credible and what isn't, that's negotiable. And the company quite often would have long discussions with the national. Well, would it be credible, for instance, to believe that you're going to have an earthquake in the middle of a hurricane? Right. Well, probably not, although it could happen. And would it be credible that you would have a 9.0 earthquake? And they may very well say, well, no, that's way beyond.
And followed by a tsunami.
That's way beyond. Yeah, followed by a tsunami.
Right. So it's hard to predict disasters of those magnitudes. Yeah.
So people are not being cavalier about safety. Nobody ever was. They spend an awful lot of time and effort making these things as safe as possible.
So do you think as a result of this disaster that the Obama administration might be changing their tune as far as their advocacy for nuclear energy goes? Or
so far, Stephen Chu, who is the he's a PhD, and he's our Department of Energy secretary, he's spoken, and no. What he's saying is that we can all learn from this, and he's saying that as of now, we really don't know what has happened. It may be that those containment vessels contain all that radiation and that very little harm is done. And it also may be that it becomes a great disaster. And I don't think anybody knows now. So it seems like the Obama administration is waiting and seeing. And that seems reasonable because you'd probably make a better decision if you wait a while.
Well, you and I talking previously, couldn't that waiting and seeing be 30 years?
It could be. It could well be. And one of the problems with the radiation is that these tumors show up sometimes as far as 30 years in the future when people have been exposed. And you really can't go back and sue a company because if you smoke and I don't, or if you use benzene, or if you do this, a lot of things happen to people over 30 years. And that's why you can get differing things, for instance, on Three Mile Island. Some people say that there's been an awful lot of damage done by that incident, and some people say none has been done. And it's really hard to quantify it. There was an interesting thing where somebody wrote an article once and said that you ought to hire old people to work in these nuclear waste places because those tumors are not going to show up, and those people are going to be dead by the time the tumor shows up. And the title of the article was, "As Long As You're Going, Would You Take Out the Trash?"
That seems a little immoral.
Well, maybe not. It might be some good jobs for some old people.
Sure.
And also, it might actually be a sensible thing.
So are you yourself an advocate for nuclear energy?
Well, if we had had this 2 weeks ago, it would have been a different conversation. Yes, I am. And just from what I saw from all the years I worked in the industry, that safety was number one. And you know, you read where people talk about people just sacrificing safety for greed, and you talk about just wild cowboys running these things. I never saw that. And when I talk to people like that, it seems like we're talking about two different things. And I should state that I have no interest. I don't have any stock in utility companies. I'm just a citizen. But, well, you have to ask yourself, what are the Japanese going to do now to replace these plants? I think the plants are just a write-off. I don't believe they'll ever be able to bring them back. But are they going to? They have no coal. They have no oil. They have no gas. They're now in rolling blackouts. And what would people who are anti-nuclear? Well, I'm rambling here, but you couldn't replace them with nuclear plants because it would take probably 10 years to build one. And you could build, say, like gas turbines in maybe a year. So they might do that, but I think all these countries are going to be looking at their nuclear options. Now, Germany is shutting their plants down. They've been doing that for a long time. And France, right next door, has got 85% nuclear, and they continue to build them. So it's not for sure which way people are going to go.
Hmm. Well, that's a very interesting fact. And unfortunately, we have used up all the time that we've got today for this interview, but there's so much more that could be talked about. And I really appreciate you joining me today.
Well, I'm glad I was able to bring some background on this thing, and thanks very much for having me, Andy.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
Yeah, goodbye.
Hi, this is MJ LaPlay, and I'm reporting for Health Writers on the Air. I want to thank Health Writers for providing me with a press pass, a newer one. My other one had expired. With that press pass, I had unlimited access to the Capitol during the occupation. The state of Wisconsin government runs that building as they wish. That is, when they screwed down the windows on the first floor, they are not in violation of any health or safety codes. because the building predates any fire codes. It was built in 1906. And that's what I want to talk to you about tonight, is the building, the Capitol. What are our tools to continue to gain access to that building? Because it's our house. What does it mean for it to be our house? I invite people to go on the tours. Free tours are offered daily, year-round, except for on the following holidays. New Year's Day, Easter, Thanksgiving, Christmas Eve, and Christmas. And also, they're not offered during occupations. Tours start at the information desk in the Rotunda area, Monday through Saturday, at 9, 10, 11 a.m., 1, 2, 3, and 4 p.m. The 4 p.m. ones Monday through Friday. And then on Sundays, it's only in the afternoon from 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, and 3 o'clock. They last 1 hour. I encourage everyone who attends to ask questions in and around the occupation as you see fit, so that the tours are not a historical only. I mean, they're historical, but they're also contemporary. When I started out on the tour, there was no mention of the occupation. And my friend said, they're not saying anything about the occupation. So then we realized, well, we had to ask a few questions. Any longer the tour, it's still about an hour. We maybe added another 10, 15 minute discussion around the building use. For instance, when we visited the Senate chamber, I asked, is this where the bill SB 11 passed? That invites other people on the tour to ask questions too. So the second tool that I will offer, too, is that there are a lot of people coming and singing regularly. Noon singing rally. There's also a Sunday morning, 10 a.m. singing in the Rotunda. Norm Stockwell explained to me that in 2005 in Nepal, radio stations were told that they could no longer read the news on the radio. So only music was permitted. So, of course, the news was sung. We might need to do some singing of the news inside the Rotunda. Also, another tool is to visit your representatives. Currently, my representative for assembly is Joe Parisi. I must say, he was pretty vacant as far as supporting the occupation. I feel that a better representative, Pope Roberts, represents Middleton. So that's another thing. Let's question representation. And by doing that tool of going and visiting the legislative offices, we start to figure out what direct democracy might look like. And it might not be representative. And so we have to start to ask ourselves, what do we want of that people's house? And to continue to realize what tools we have and what tools we need yet to develop.
Each day, more and more information is coming to light about the attacks on working people in Wisconsin and the damaging effects these attacks will have on our lives. Libraries make an essential contribution to the health of our society because they are a place where people are given equal access to information. This institution's funding, however, is in the sights of the state budget bill, which is currently being considered. At Library Legislation Day, which took place at the Capitol this Tuesday, I spoke with concerned librarians and library supporters from all over the state who are looking to have their voices heard. They had a lot to say about how this bill will affect the Wisconsin library system and about the essential role libraries play in our communities. Of great concern is the move to remove laws which create funding mandates for libraries. Also proposed are steep cuts which will severely limit the services libraries provide and even force many libraries around the state to close their doors.
We are threatened on several counts. The biggest one is maintenance of effort, which is the law that's been in effect since 1972 that states that communities must fund libraries at a three-year average. Governor Walker's bill, that goes away. So with the burden of having to fund the police at their current efforts and not having any other resources, libraries stand the chance of losing most of their funding next year. And so we're here to remind the legislatures that during tough economic times, libraries are a strong community resources, especially for people who are looking for jobs, and especially in rural areas where what side of the street you live on depends on whether you have broadband. Most companies today require people to fill their applications out online. So if you don't have access to broadband, you can't fill your application out. How are you going to get a job?
Rock County right now is at about 16% unemployment. we want to get our people working, and cutting off critical resources like information and access is really the wrong way to do it. We're also here to talk about our villages, our communities that don't have any resources for raising revenue. So they're going to be cutting everywhere, everything. So it's a big deal and it's a big issue.
What do you think you can accomplish here today?
It's just letting legislators know what we are and what we're doing and why we're important. I don't think that the legislators realize why we are important. I don't think they realize that for many rural communities like Delavan, like Clinton, we are the way that people are getting jobs. We are their computer access. And I think it's hard because many people see us as a frivolous service, and we are not. We are how young children get ready for school if parents can't afford preschool. We're how seniors keep their minds active by having access to books, having access to programs, having access to somebody who they can talk to once a day when they come in and renew their books, and somebody who keeps an eye on and says, hey, wait a minute, so-and-so hasn't shown up today. Maybe we need to call and have the police do a welfare check. We're the way people learn computer skills. We're a safe place for teenagers to go. We are a community center. We're not just a warehouse for books. And it's time people realize that. And they have to realize it now, before the libraries go away and they start going, wait a minute, we used to be able to and now we can't.
Are there any long-term plans? Because this is just one budget and the economy seems like it's going to be stagnating for a while. Do you have long-term plans fighting for funding?
I've been a public library director for 17 years. Every year is an ongoing conversation and education and even fight for fair funding. I did a chart, and we have not had more than $100 increase in 10 years.
So asked for more funding?
I don't think this is the year to ask for more. I think this is the year to ask us to at least hold.
If you connect the dots, I think it becomes apparent that Walker's strategy is to dismantle public services in Wisconsin as we know it and replace them with private, for-profit operations. We can see in his legislation a pattern of slashing funding for education, energy, and transportation services, and in turn promoting private charter schools, selling off publicly operated power plants, and slashing funding for public transit, which would pave the way for a private takeover. These are very scary prospects we face, but I've been heartened by the people I've been meeting in and around the Capitol for the last month. To close, I'd like to share a short clip from MAA, an artist with ties to the semi-autonomous region in Sri Lanka. But first, here are the thoughts of people participating in the occupation of the Capitol on the night of Wednesday, February 16th, just 3 days into the first week of protests. I think the experience of having to fight is making people draw more and more radical conclusions. What do you think?
I'm here because it's really fun. It's fun to camp out here and feel like we're doing something collectively.
You know, just being cynical about things isn't going to make anything happen. You can't dismantle the system by staying home and eating pizza. So I just thought, you know, you've got to go out and do something instead of just being eternally dissatisfied.
I think people are really starting to realize that it's a struggle between the working class and the elite. They may not have realized that before. I think it's slowly but surely that realization is coming to fruition. Second of all, I think people are starting to see how things are more interconnected. Each cause is a common denominator, and that's that there's a corporate dominance in the United States that is dictating policy, the way policy turns on every single issue. And here in Wisconsin, it's right here, what we're listening to right now, it's workers' rights, it's funding for education. It can't be a single issue thing. We have to start fighting the system itself. And so that's where we're at.
These politicians, you know, what are they doing? We shouldn't even have to be here. They're not working for us at all. They're not working for people at all. They're working for their vested interests in themselves. You know, private profit, private gain, only for themselves. Because if they were really working for the people of this country, the people of this city, the people of this state, they'd be working for us and we wouldn't have to be here. You know, we wouldn't have to raise our voices. Yeah, this is a big turning point, especially for Madison, Wisconsin.
and there's amazing miracles going on all the time, and we're at the change of eras.
I think it really is a movement. I mean, it's been the movement that's been going on for a long time, and people keep paralleling this to Egypt. And it's the same thing. Like, you know, we see things like this happen in other countries and we say that it's wrong and it's terrible, but things like this happened here and all of a sudden we think it's just permissible because things like that can't happen in the United States because we're so far advanced and beyond any of these other societies that have problems like this. So we need to make sure that we're not falling into traps that we think other nations do. We need to fight for ourselves as much as we need to fight for other countries.
The Dark Ages weren't fun.
Well, I guess I'm always just worried that more of our rights are going to be taken away. Kind of like with the Patriot Act, I feel like this is another step in the wrong direction for the state. And so I guess I'm just more worried about more of our rights being taken away.
In general, it's not just about the bill, so I would like to see thinking more critically and practically about just kind of the mechanics of day-to-day life and the invisible labor that goes unthanked and consideration of all of those kind of nitty-gritty daily realities that most people have to deal with, but that obviously the most privileged don't.
Where I think it is headed is to the re-empowerment of people, of ordinary people who live, work, and vote in Wisconsin. We saw this in 2008. A lot of people became politically active, and it kind of went back underground. And now I think people are realizing that they do have power and that they can use it, and that together they can create the lives they want to live.
It's also a multi-generational thing because I've seen older workers and younger students, people of all generations, sort of coalescing around this thing, I think.
Makes me feel empowered, and I'm glad to be part of it.
To the Capitol.
Come to the Capitol.
Make
let's occupy
bigger and bigger.
It.
Yeah.
Don't stop.
Yeah.
Okay, karaoke.
Raise hell.
Thank you for listening to Health Riders. That does it for tonight's program. For archives of past programs, please visit our website at www.healthriders.wordpress.com.